The following presentation was recorded at the CLP Writers and Artists Conference. More information at clp.org.
We've been looking at the majesty of God. I find it inspiring. I find it heartwarming to look at the works of God. I find it enriching to my faith. This morning, the message, though, I'm going to be approaching it from somewhat of a different angle. We're looking at the majesty of God, illustrating the majesty of God in our lives. I think of pictures, visual pictures in our lives. Well, how do we pull this together? I don't know for sure, actually, what the program committee wanted on this session. I thought perhaps it was an attempt to pull the artists into this. I don't know how well I'm going to do that. I'm going to focus primarily on how this happens in our lives. How do we illustrate God's majesty in our lives? I invite you to turn in your Bibles this morning, not to a psalm, but to one of Paul's letters, 1 Corinthians chapter 1. And going to be looking at... He doesn't use the word majesty in this passage, but he uses the word glory. And the focus is on the glory of God. 1 Corinthians 1, toward the end of the chapter, I'm going to be starting with verse 20. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe, the writer? Where is the disputer of this world, or the philosopher, the good thinker? Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For after that in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God. Isn't that a terrible irony? By wisdom knew not God. It pleased God by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. For the Jews require a sign, and the Greeks seek after wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, unto the Jews a stumbling block, and unto the Greeks foolishness. But unto them which are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God, and the wisdom of God, because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. For you see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called, but God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, and God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty, and base things of the world, and things which are despised hath God chosen, yea, and the things which are not, to bring to naught things that are. Again, almost a terrible irony in this language. Purpose, verse 29, that no flesh should glory in his presence. But of him are ye in Christ, who of God is made unto us wisdom and righteousness and sanctification and redemption, that according as it is written, he that glorieth, let him glory in the Lord. God is full of majesty. God is majestic. We have noted that. We've seen that in the works of God. In the creative work of God, in the redemptive work of God, we see that God is majestic. When it comes to us, however, how do we experience such majesty or illustrate such majesty in our lives? Well, we could try to think of the best human achievements, of the highest, of the greatest of human achievements. But in this passage, Paul says that God actually chooses the weak and the nobodies, the despised, the base, the lowly, the people who are not anything in themselves, to do things that are great, that bring glory to his name. if we're going to show the pictures of God, the majesty of God in our lives, we have to be careful how we aspire to do that. Again, let's just notice the words that Paul uses, verse 27, beginning here, God hath chosen foolish. Foolish is in contrast to wise. Weak. He's chosen the weak. In contrast to the powerful. He's chosen the base. I think the translators struggle probably with translation here. What does the Greek word? It's actually genes. It's a genealogy without name, without genealogy. It would be the literal idea, or it's the maybe in our vernacular, street urchins. It's the people without family, the people without any claim by virtue of lineage, the despised versus the honorable or the honored, the nobodies, the things which are not versus the somebodies. God has chosen these to accomplish, to show who He is. And so I'd like to think with you about God and how God uses human weakness to display His majesty. What I'd like to consider with you as we go through this, is to realize that the pictures, the illustrations of the majesty of God happen in the very simple, and sometimes even worse than simple, in the messiness of human experience. And from our perspective, it's difficult for us to see anything majestic in this, many times in this work of God, when we are in it. But we see this. This is a regular pattern of God. This is something which He has done again and again and again. He has used the nobodies, the despised, those that we would, even in our way of thinking, we would tend to look down upon. And I just pulled a number of biblical characters, want to pull them before you and help us to think about illustrating the majesty of God in our lives. When the Israelites came to the border of Canaan, they the second time around, when they were on the across the Jordan, they sent a couple of spies in to check out Jericho. And these spies were housed in a hostel, in some kind of a arrangement, an inn or whatever, by Rahab, who is named as a prostitute. We would understand that this apparently was a part of the arrangement for the keeping there, for the innkeeping, that she offered sexual services to her guests. She belonged to a group of people who were so corrupt that God had said they are to be obliterated. They are to be wiped out, given over completely to destruction. Rahab was without lineage. She was without, she was odd genus. She was a nobody. She was somebody that we would have looked down upon. But something had happened in Rahab's heart, in the reports that they had heard of this people. And when she pulls these spies allows them into her inn, the investigators come almost immediately. I don't know what kind of system they had, what kind of police force or whatever, but somebody was there. The FBI showed up at her door, and she had them hid. She hid them. And then this is what she said. Listen to this woman's words. She says, I know that the Lord hath given you the land, and that your terror is fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land faint because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you. Listen to the works of God there. When you came out of Egypt, and what He did, what you did to the two kings of the Amorites that were on the other side Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom ye utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts did melt, neither did there remain any more courage in any man because of you, for the Lord your God, He is God, in heaven above and in earth beneath. That's quite a statement of faith from a woman whose morals we would look at and say, what kind of woman is this? Rahab was willing actually to put her own life in jeopardy because of this bud of a faith in God, this budding faith in God. Somehow she knew that this people is in contact with the God of the universe, and she put her trust in Him. She actually joined the Israelites then. She was spared. And we could look at her maybe initially and say she's just saving her own hide here. Okay? And yet, she does seem to become a woman of faith who put her trust in the Lord. She joined the Israelites. She married a man by the name of Salmon, and they had a son by the name of Boaz. Boaz is a man of character. Boaz is a man of character in the time of the judges when there was much apostasy. As far as we know, Rahab never wrote a book. We have no record of her writing anything. As far as we know, Rahab never drew any pictures or never did any great things. She would probably have considered herself unfit to be an author. But her story has been included in the Word of God. Her great-great-grandson was David. And from her lineage, Jesus was born. Rahab's life shows us the majesty of the grace and goodness of God. Pictures of His majesty in lives. We see God at work in this woman, in her heart. And we take hope, we take courage when we see His majesty illustrated in a life like this. If God can use a woman like this, perhaps He can use me as well. Pictures of His majesty. In a similar same era, sometime after Rahab, there was a family in Israel and there was a famine. In Israel, things were not going well. We would assume that it's probably because of some of the apostasy that goes on. The book of Judges is, by the way, a very dark book. It's a book that I read and I study and look at and see the stories, and we wonder, what in the world? How could God continue to work with a people like this? But this family goes to neighboring country of Moab, down around the other side of the Dead Sea, and they sojourn. They live there for a time. This family has two young men, and these two young men marry two young ladies from Moab. One of them is Ruth, and we're told that story in this same era. Here is a Moabite. The Moabites were not acceptable. God had said that the Moabites don't come into this, my people, until the 10th generation. Here is Ruth. And shortly after her marriage, her husband dies. Her brother-in-law dies. Her father-in-law dies. She is left as a young widow. Widows in those days had it difficult. They had no one to care for them, and typically they went back to their parental home. Here is Ruth. But somehow in Ruth's interaction with this family, she comes also to the awareness that this people knows God. And here's how she expresses her faith. Very familiar words probably to us. She says to her mother-in-law, "Entreat me not to leave thee or to return from following after thee, for whither thou goest, I will go. Where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God. Whither thou diest, will I die, and there will I be buried. The Lord Jehovah do so to me, and more also, if aught but death part thee and me." As a Moabite, she would have been considered unfit to be received among the people of God, but she's taken in. She marries Rahab's son Boaz, and we wonder, here is Boaz, his realization, perhaps, that his mother is a foreigner, and he's very sensitive. You know, this is how God uses our difficulties. He makes us sensitive to others. And here is Boaz, and he is sensitive toward this foreigner, and he is respectful of her faith, and he says to her, the whole village, everybody knows that you are a virtuous woman, and he demonstrates virtue himself. Marries her, and again, this is a part of the lineage of Jesus. Pictures of God's majesty. Illustrations in life. We could look at Gideon. Again, similar era. Gideon considered himself weak. This is a time of apostasy, and this is a time when things are not going well. The Midianites came in and overran the Israelites to the point to an oppressive point where it's hard for us to understand even how they existed. And Gideon is out in I get the mixed up. Was he threshing wheat in a wine vat, or was he doing Anyway, so he's doing this in secret. It's a survival situation, and the angel of the Lord appears to him and refers to him as with a title of honor. You're a commander. And Gideon's initial response is not, oh, wow, this is great. His initial response is, if this is so, how is it that God's people are overrun? Aren't we the people that God has brought out of Egypt? He can't put together this goodness and greatness of God in the past with the circumstances they're going through. And when the angel tells him, God has chosen you, he says, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house. How can I save Israel? God has chosen the foolish things, the weak things, the things that are not, to accomplish things that bring glory to his name. And God did this further with Gideon. You know, what is remarkable about Gideon is not his physical strength and ability. It is his faith. God ends up giving him an army and taking it away en masse. And Gideon is left with 300 men against this huge, huge people. Illustrating the majesty of God in our lives. We could think of David. David's story, David taken from as a shepherd. He's not a warrior at that point, he is a shepherd. He's the youngest in his family. He wasn't even called in when Samuel came to anoint one of Jesse's sons. And eventually he was called in then. Well, he's the youngest. He's out with the sheep. He's brought in and anointed. Think of Jesus being born from Mary. Mary, a young lady from Nazareth. Nazareth, of all places. You know, I would hesitate to do this, but we could name places in the United States, perhaps, where we could say, there? Any good thing come out of there? That's what they said about Nazareth. Jesus, born of Mary. We can think of the disciples. They were fishermen, untrained men. One was a publican, a tax collector. People hated the tax collectors. The Jews looked down on them. They equated the tax collectors with sinners. It's a common expression, the tax collectors and sinners. That's just the expression that they had. And Jesus pulled one of those men into being one of the 12 disciples. God uses weakness to confound the world. It is a way that he illustrates his majesty. Does this mean, then, that we should attempt to be foolish, that we should attempt to be base, weak, despised, nobodies? Does this mean we should avoid training, that we should avoid sharpening our skills? And the answer is absolutely not. We certainly want to give God the best that we have. And yet we recognize that God even in our best, we are inadequate for illustrating the majesty of God. It is worthy of the best of human expression, who God is and his majesty. We should write the best stories that we can, do the best illustrating, do the best music, the best hymns that we can to demonstrate, to express the glory of God, and yet recognize that many times he will do this through our weaknesses. It means that we should regularly, if we're going to allow the majesty of God to be illustrated in our lives, that we will need to be regularly exposing our hearts and lives to his majesty, that we will devote our resources to him, our talents, our lives to him. It will mean also that we will accept those times when he touches our hip, the times when he does things to us that show us our weakness. We typically don't like these times. We many times misunderstand God in these times when God does give us weakness. The Apostle Paul was a man who was trained, a man who was educated, but God gave him. He gave him a weakness. He gave him something which was painful, which was difficult, which Paul begged the Lord for relief. And it is there where God taught Paul this glorious truth that his majesty, his glory, is made known many times in weakness. And Paul says, okay, bring it on. I glory in weakness. Honestly, folks, I am not as spiritual as Paul is. I'm still saying, Lord, please don't bring any more. That's more where I am. I don't enjoy this. Tozer, I think it was, who said, God never uses a person greatly until he wounds him deeply. And it's a part of God's arrangement. It's a part of the way he works. And we need to be people who are willing to accept what God does in our lives. How God uses us. Now, we've looked at just the realization that God uses human weakness, he uses even suffering, he uses things that are wrong to bring about great things, things that are right and things that reflect his glory. But how God does this is his prerogative. It's not for us necessarily to choose how God will illustrate his majesty in our lives. In fact, the reality is that many times when we are in the middle of our being used by God, it will not seem that way. In the middle of the story, we could go back to all of these stories, and in the middle of the story, it looks messy, it looks wrong, it does not look glorious at all. Sometimes it almost seems as though God, he certainly allows. I never know quite what terms to use. The biblical writers almost seem more bold. They will almost more regularly assign things that are going really bad to the hand of God. We struggle with that, and I don't think that we ought to assign evil to God's hands. That we ought to say God allows evil to happen in the world because he is a God who can turn evil, he can turn what people do against him into the very thing which accomplishes his intentions. That's the majesty and the glory of God. So he allows these things, and yet we do find that sometimes we are faced with things that we hardly know how to think about them. Is this from the hand of God, or is this from the hand of evil? Is this something that we ought to resist and pray against, or is it and pray for deliverance from, or is it something we ought to accept? We get confused sometimes as we're in the middle of our stories. But our lives also, God intends that your life, every life here, be stamped with his majesty, with his glory. He wants to do God things in our lives. But when we're in it, it won't always seem that way. It'll seem sometimes as though things have fallen apart. Things are not going the way they should go. I'll come forward now from the biblical stories more to our era. Or at least closer to our era. First story I'm thinking about is Annie Johnson. You may be familiar with her story. She has written many poems. Born in 1866, Christmas Eve, 1866, kind of a nice play, a time to be born, I guess, Christmas Eve. But her mother died 3 years later, after the birth of Annie's sister. Her father had a chronic disease, in fact, a terminal disease, and he was concerned about his daughters, and he gave them to a widow to take care of. This widow already had a number of children, and the arrangement was not good. I don't know all the details of it, but the arrangement was not good. And there was a single school teacher named Susie who got to know these girls, and she actually took them in and started talking. Susie stayed with a family by the name of Flint. They took, and she was talking to them about these girls, and she would do things with the girls, and the Flint family decided to ask for the girls if they could take them, so they, and they did. And the father was agreeing to this. They took them into the Flint home. And shortly after this, the father passed away. Father died. And so Annie grew up, Annie Johnson grew up in the Flint home, took on actually that surname also. Annie Johnson Flint is a name that she has, is known by. And after she was grown, she was interested in education, became a school teacher, was a school teacher for a number of years. And then began having health problems, starting having difficulty, particularly with arthritis. And to the point that she didn't know, was not able to teach school anymore. And she started writing poems. And she would write and make her own cards and send them to friends and so on. People came across her poetry and were so blessed by this, they began asking for her poetry. And eventually she did some publishing, published poetry, made cards, and began actually to care for herself, have an income this way, although it was meager. But her situation deteriorated. She finally got so bad that she could not write anymore. Even while she was writing, there were people who wondered how in the world, as crippled as she was, how could she write? For 40 years, she lived in constant pain, eventually dictating her poetry. In 1932, she passed away. She was 66 years old. Her biographer writes this: Annie became thoroughly convinced that God intended to glorify himself through her in her weak earthen vessel, and like Paul, she had three times and more prayed that this might be taken from her. There came to her with real assurance the promise which said, "My grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness." I just pause here and in reading this and note that one of the things that troubled her is she did have people coming to her saying, if you believed in God, he could heal you. She had this pressure. And this is, she finally came to this assurance that this was given to her for the glory of God. She reached a place, reading on now, she reached a place where she could also say with Paul, "Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me." She believed that God had laid her aside for a purpose, even though that purpose was obscure to her at times. But she also believed that he had work for her to do, and she could put her very best into the writing of her poems, rendering this ministry unto him. The result has been that her verses have had an unusually deep appeal to human hearts. The simple reason is that she felt what she wrote, and out of the crucible of suffering, she was able to administer that comfort to others wherewith she herself had been comforted of God. A number of years ago, my wife and I and our family had taken some days away. We were involved in a fairly heavy ministry and counseling at that point, and sometimes like to just get away with our family. And we did this. This was over a weekend, and so we went to a church. It was, I think we went to a Nazarene church that morning, and we're there, and the pastor and his daughter sang a song. And this song so moved us. We were involved in heavy ministry and sometimes hardly knowing how to carry some of it. This was the song that they sang. I didn't know at the time, but it was written by Annie Johnson Flint. "He giveth more grace when the burdens grow greater He sendeth more strength when the labors increase. To added affliction, he addeth his mercy. To multiplied trials, he multiplied his multiplied peace. When we have exhausted our store of endurance, when our strength has failed ere the day is half done, when we reach the end of our hoarded resources, our Father's full giving is only begun. His love has no limit. His grace has no measure. His power has no boundary known unto men. For out of his infinite riches in Jesus, he giveth and giveth and giveth again. A number of years ago, a good friend of mine was dying of cancer. And I had regular contact with him, but I deeply appreciated his encouragement. He was such an encourager. I think for a variety of reasons, I'm not certain why, maybe all of us need encouragement at times, but I enjoyed him as a brother who encouraged me. It was such a blessing. But he was dying. Cancer taking his health. And In interaction with him, I remembered another poem by Annie Johnson Flint, and I sent it to him at that time. And I'll read it for you here. I Will Not Doubt is the title of the poem. I will not doubt, though all my ships at sea come drifting home with broken masts and sails. I will believe the hand which never fails from seeming evil worketh good for me. And though I weep because those sails are tattered, still will I cry while my best hopes lie shattered. I trust in thee. I will not doubt, though all my prayers return unanswered from the still white realm above. I will believe it is an all-wise love which hath refused the things which for which I yearn. And though at times I cannot keep from grieving, yet the pure ardor of my fixed believing undimmed shall burn. I will not doubt, though sorrows fall like rain and troubles swarm like bees around a hive. I will believe the heights for which I strive are only reached by anguish and by pain. And though I groan and writhe beneath my crosses, I yet shall see through my severest losses the greater gain. And I attended Dave's funeral. They had this poem on the funeral bulletin. We illustrate the majesty of God through broken lives. And so if we think that the majesty of God is going to mean great things for us, we may at times be disappointed. God shows his greatness and his glory many times through our brokenness. We don't understand him. And sometimes, as I said in our last session, when we get into the middle, when we're in the middle of difficulty, it's easy for us to lose sight of God. It's easy for those things to obscure, even sometimes for us to think things untrue about God, opposites. We tend to think, we hear God is love, and we say, if God is love, why this? We hear God cares for us. If God cares for us, why this? We hear God answers prayer. If God answers prayer, why not mine? We go through these things, and in the middle of the experiences that are confusing to us, it does not look majestic. It does not look glorious to us. And so I conclude here with us having us think about what is our response. And the response was summarized in Annie's poem here. It is a response of trust. We need to trust him, to believe in him, and to believe that even when it doesn't make sense to us, that doesn't mean that it won't make sense in the bigger plan. Even when it does not feel good to us, does not mean that it's not good in long range. Trust is not easy for us. We like to know what is going on. We like to know what God is doing. The reality is that many times the intentions of God are beyond us. They are beyond what we can see. It always encourages us when we know His intentions. That's always encouraging. When we can see what God's intentions are, we can sometimes handle the difficulty better. But from our experience, it will not always seem as though He's doing good things. Just a few weeks ago, our daughter was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma. And she's been married less than a year. She's got married last June. From our perspective, we'd look at this and say, this isn't the time. This isn't right. God isn't, he's overlooking something here. She just has had her first treatment of chemo and is scheduled for having chemo every other week for 6 months. First week after her treatment, she experienced the downside, sore mouth, soreness in her whole body, just those difficulties. And at sometimes we've heard different things from her. This is early on for her. She's just struggling through this, trying to sort through it. It's difficult for us as parents. Sometimes it seems that looking on is almost more difficult than having the experience yourself. Those of you who have looked on, you'll understand. Proper response is a response of trust. Trust that says, God, you are God, and we don't know. We don't know how you will, how the story will end, what good things you will bring out of these kinds of things, but God is able to do that. And our response is to be a response of trust. We trust Him because He is God. Nothing changes in who God is when we go through difficulty. He is the same. He is the same today as He was a month ago. He's the same today as He was a week ago. The same today as He was a year ago. The same today as He was in Gideon's time, in Abraham's time, in Daniel's time. He is the same. And His, from our perspective, we can look at the clouds. What's the song that we sang? We can look at the clouds, scan His clouds, and we struggle with trying to find the intentions, the purposes of God. We don't have to know those purposes in order to trust Him. Our call is to trust. And He knows what He's doing. Illustrating the majesty of God in our lives, my point here today, this morning, is just to realize that all of this assignment that we have to express His majesty, to see His majesty, to verbalize it, to put it into words, to illustrate His majesty, comes from lives who trust Him, from lives who know Him, from lives who have anchored everything on His promises, on His character, on who He is. Some of the things that I have shared with you this morning by way of illustration may seem maybe the easier ones almost. There are some kinds of experiences that we go through that are even more confusing than the ones that I've told you. And I think probably, I won't go into giving examples of this, but I'm just saying, if you have interacted with friends or family members who get into sin, who are struggling in sin, and there are times when this gets terribly confusing in terms of knowing how can God bring good out of these kinds of situations. And I do want to emphasize that His majesty is illustrated in the lives of those who trust Him. When we reject Him, there are other responses. We can get angry at God. We can sometimes turn away from Him. History is also full of stories of people who in trial and difficulty turned away. They said, if this is what God is like, I don't want anything to do with Him. It does call us to trust. But I'd also encourage you, sometimes you need to trust in behalf of others. And I don't mean that you can substitute your faith for theirs, but I am saying that it is that's a part of our calling also. We are called to pray, to bring before the Lord, before this throne of mercy and goodness and majesty, we bring before Him the lives of people who are not trusting Him, the lives of people who are not following Him. This also can be very confusing for God's people as we experience life in all its complexities. Illustrating God's majesty in our lives, the pictures at the end of the story make sense. They're beautiful. In the middle, it doesn't look that way. God bless you. I don't know where your particular story is. If you're in a time of confusion, if you're a time of faith, or where you are, my encouragement to you this morning is to trust Him. He is a majestic God, and He will make all things right. This is my Father's world. Song. And though the right seems oft, and though the wrong seems so strong, God is the ruler yet. Yes, this is our Father's world. He will make all things right. God bless you.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.